Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Rita is barreling its way toward the Texas and Louisiana coasts, creating massive gridlock on roads leading out of Houston. Earlier today, a bus carrying elderly evacuees exploded and caught fire outside Dallas, killing some two dozen people. And in already hurricane-ravaged New Orleans, water is rising in the city's impoverished Ninth Ward. The area had been pumped dry after Hurricane Katrina, but now a waterfall at least 30 feet wide is pouring over a dike that was being used to patch breaks in a levee. Rita's powerful winds, now clocked at about 135 miles an hour, are expected to come ashore early tomorrow. Although Galveston and Houston will likely escape the brunt of the storm, National Hurricane Center meteorologist Mark McInerney says they are still not in the clear.
The current eye is supposed to go in between Galveston and, say, the Louisiana border. However, hurricane-force winds are outwards of 85 miles from the center, so the eye itself isn't necessarily the focus, because on either side of that 85 miles, you're going to get hurricane-force winds.
Port Arthur, Texas, is one of the communities directly in Rita's path. Police Lieutenant Rodney Balsamo joins us on the line. Lieutenant, there are 47,000 residents in Port Arthur. How's the evacuation going? Are people experiencing the crippling traffic jams that we've been seeing on television?
The traffic headed north is clearing. For the most part, the city has been evacuated. We still have a few people that are calling and requesting assistance in getting out, and we're doing the best we can to get these people out.
Mm-hmm. We've all heard the reports about motorists running out of gasoline and becoming stranded. Is there enough gasoline for folks who are trying to leave?
There's still a few places that has gasoline, and I think the problem with the motorists being stranded and running out was due to the fact that there was so much time spent idling. If they run out of gas and we come across them, we're going to get them somewhere safe.
So is that what you're hearing from right now when you say you're hearing from folks asking for help? Are you hearing from folks who need to get to a safe area and are unable to because of gasoline shortages or other reasons?
The people that we're hearing from now are the people, I guess, that initially weren't going to leave, and now they've decided to leave or waited to the last minute to leave for whatever reason, and that they have no transportation or we're still dealing with a few special needs.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing? Is there a shelter that you're taking these folks to? What's happening?
Presently, we've got operations at our airport where we're using military aircraft to evacuate people by the busload.
To where? To different parts?
We're bringing some of them to the airport. They're evacuating them all over the country.
And do you know how many people we're talking about?
Our city alone has 47,000 people in it. How many we've evacuated, the only number that I can really give you is just during the last 12 hours, we've evacuated over 10,000 people.
What about the businesses in the area and the refineries? What's happening there?
The refineries, they usually have their own evacuation plans, and those are intact. They're working with our emergency management team to ensure that those refineries are secure, as well as either non-operational or operational, whatever their needs are.
You know, we've heard from some folks who are describing the evacuation from coastal areas as being a complete mess and sort of indicative that maybe we didn't learn any lessons from Hurricane Katrina because this isn't being planned properly. What would you say to that?
I would have to disagree. I mean, when you're trying to move that many people to the northern part of the state or even out of the state, it looks like a complete mess. You know, it's no different than if you let 30,000 people out of a sporting event. You know, for a while, there's going to be a problem.
And so what do you do from here? When do you leave the area?
We're kind of playing that by ear. We're watching the weather radar and listening to our state emergency management office as to the position of the storm.
Lieutenant Rodney Balsamo is with the Port Arthur, Texas Police Department. And while the primary focus during a massive hurricane is preventing the loss of life, there's also a significant threat to the economy and the environment. That's particularly true in the case of Rita, thanks to the huge chemical and oil plants that line the corridor between Port Arthur and Corpus Christi, Texas. These plants account for roughly 2% of the country's total economic output, a staggering $150 billion a year. Stephanie Cohen is a reporter for Dow Jones Market Watch. And Stephanie, give us a sense of how important this region is when it comes to U.S. oil production.
quite important. It's probably what we'd call the heart of it. In addition to Louisiana, these are the two most heavily concentrated areas for refinery capacity in the country. Right now, the focus here is on 21 oil refineries that are along the Texas coast that could be impacted by the storm.
And how many of them are shut down?
At the close of yesterday, it was 14. And this is workers just being completely evacuated from these facilities and then being shut down and prepared to try and withstand some of the rain and flooding that is expected.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the other companies in the area, like Dow Chemical?
There are a lot of chemical companies in the area as well, and they're also facing the same exact problems. The two biggest issues that we saw in Louisiana that we'll probably see here again in Texas, most people expect, is loss of electricity to these plants and flooding. Once the plants get flooded, you have to wait for the flooding to go away before you can restore electricity to the plants and they can begin to operate again.
Do these companies have emergency plans? You would think that after September 11th, that there would be plans for a major refining area of the country, major chemical plants. Do they?
They do, and they've been, Texas has been sort of the second chance for them to look back at what happened in Louisiana, and that in part is why we've seen the evacuation starting much earlier here. You're actually having, especially for the oil refineries that have shut down 1 to 2 days in advance, the lack of capacity coming out of them, one, hurts when we're looking at the big picture because the fuel is not flowing out of them, but at the same time, companies decided we need to get people out of here quickly, we need to get people out of here early as a precaution.
Mm-hmm. And they will be protected, they think?
They do. I think flooding is the big issue. They are built to withstand storms generally. Whether or not they will suffer damage depends on where the heart of the storm hits in the region. If it hits Houston, if it hits Port Arthur, which port it hits will determine the damage.
Mm-hmm. And obviously then there's gas prices. I read some analysts are now predicting gas will be up to $4 a gallon on average within the next 2 weeks. Could this be worse than Katrina in terms of its effect on gas prices?
What we saw after Hurricane Katrina was we saw a quick spike in prices, and then pretty quickly prices did trickle back down once facilities began to come online, back online, and that is what is generally expected when you have a storm hit. And so gasoline prices are guaranteed to be affected. One, it's hard to say by how much. The big thing that the industry and the government is watching right now are there are three major pipelines coming out of Texas that ship fuel of various sorts, gasoline, jet fuel, to the upper Midwest and to the Northeast. And if these pipelines go down, you see supply crunches all the way up the chain. Two of these pipelines have already been shut down in advance, and that's cutting back on fuel going up to Chicago, fuel going to Oklahoma, fuel going to the Northeast.
And we're already down because of Katrina.
That's right. There was there's 5% of refining capacity that is still down as a result of Katrina, and now you're seeing the bulk of the production facilities and the refinery capacity in Texas now shut down on top of that.
Stephanie, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stephanie Cohen is a reporter for Market Watch, which is based in Washington, D.C. We turn now to the storm of violence in Iraq. Two more American soldiers died overnight in the western part of the country, bringing the number of Americans killed in the Iraq War to 1,912. This weekend, there are expected to be large pro- and anti-Iraq War demonstrations in Washington, which prompted President Bush yesterday to reiterate his opposition to a withdrawal of U.S. troops. Today, we look at what's happening inside Iraq in two hotspots. Joining us first is Timothy Phelps. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Newsday and a veteran Mideast reporter. Tim, you've been writing about the tense situation this week in the once relatively peaceful southern Iraqi city of Basra. One diplomat you spoke with called the situation there our dirty little secret. What does that mean?
It means that there's just as much trouble in a different way in the south of Iraq as the trouble that we've been watching every day around Baghdad, because the Shia militias that very much control the South don't like Americans and British and foreigners any more than the Sunni insurgents do. And in a way, we really have two insurgencies going on, the Shia insurgency in the South and the Sunni insurgency in Baghdad.
Hmm. Explain what happened, the trouble in Basra this week, briefly, if you could.
Well, on Sunday, the British arrested some key members of one of the Shia militias belonging to Sheikh Muqtada Sadr. And the next day, two of their undercover soldiers got in an altercation and found themselves arrested by the Iraqi police, whom the British have been training for the last 2 years. And the British found themselves attacking one of the very police stations that they've been rebuilding themselves, and finally managed to free their two soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And also, there is concern about that agents of Iran have infiltrated, yes, the local security police in Basra?
Well, yes. Most likely it's not Iranians, but actually Iraqis, I'm told, who are on the payroll of Iran. Many of these people in the police are militia members who lived in Iran for 20 years, so there's a natural connection there.
Mm-hmm. Iraq's foreign minister says that what is happening in Basra is a, quote, local flare-up. Do you think this will be resolved, and do you agree with that description?
Well, I think it will be papered over. They'll get over this sort of diplomatic confrontation, but the government of Baghdad doesn't necessarily control what's going on down there in Basra. The local authorities have much more to do with it, and this problem between the British and the Shia militias is not going to go away.
Mm-hmm. So explain, are the police to be trusted in that area?
When I was there in July, the British consulate advised me, if I got into trouble, not to go to the police. Can you imagine? Because they predicted, which is what's apparently happened this week with their two soldiers, that the police will simply hand you over to the militias.
Hmm. And if you look at this in sort of a broader context, the Saudi foreign minister yesterday told reporters that Iraq is moving toward disintegration and violence could spread to other countries in the region because of that. Is Basra an example of that?
Basra is the prime example of that. Originally, we thought, well, it was just the Kurds in the north who wanted their own country. But over the last several months, the Shia in the south, starting in Basra, decided they'd like their own independence. And I think that prediction, unfortunately, is likely to come true, that the country will split up into three pieces and that it's liable to create all sorts of tensions with the neighbors around it.
Well, Timothy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Timothy Phelps is Washington Bureau Chief for Newsday. Just ahead, we speak with Jonathan Finer with The Washington Post. He was embedded with U.S. troops in another part of Iraq near the border with Syria. Also, we hear from poet Sharon Olds about why she's refusing an invitation from First Lady Laura Bush to attend this weekend's National Book Festival. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about the ongoing violence in Iraq and what it means for the United States. We've just heard from a veteran Mideast reporter who described his concerns about southern Iraq. Now to the western part of the country, where Washington Post reporter Jonathan Finer recently was embedded with the U.S. Army on a mission to wipe out insurgents there. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the mission, the Army mission that was taking place and where it was located and what was happening.
Well, I was in the city of Talafer, which is a city of a bit more than 200,000 people, located about 40 miles from the Syrian border, that has basically been controlled by insurgents for the last year or so, and the U.S. military decided they didn't want this to be such a hub for the insurgency any longer and decided to launch a big offensive. More than 8,000 U.S. and Iraqi soldiers involved, the largest sort of single urban offensive since the siege of Fallujah last November.
And this offensive included the roundup of men in Talafer. Can you describe that?
Well, that's right. What essentially happened was the insurgents who were there, they thought there were sort of 300 to 500. Most of them tried to blend into the civilian population or flee the city, and so it turned into something of a one big police roundup where they brought all the military-age men they could find into custody and tried to determine whether or not they were actually the ones fighting them. And it's a real uphill battle for these soldiers because they don't speak the language and have very little sort of understanding of the local culture and therefore made it very difficult to discern who was responsible for some of these insurgent attacks and who was just a regular civilian.
Mm-hmm. And in identifying the folks that you saw rounded up in Talafer, how were they identified and what happened? Was it informants that they used to identify them?
Well, in going through these neighborhoods, they would rely very heavily on these people they call their sources, which are essentially local informants who would wear masks to protect their identities and sort of walk through the crowd pointing out people that they deemed to be part of the insurgency and people that they deemed to be innocent, essentially. And the interesting thing was that oftentimes these informants, the soldiers that were working with them didn't really know much about them, didn't know their names, didn't know their backgrounds, didn't know what sort of agendas or vendettas they might have. But because of the limitations in terms of local knowledge and language that the soldiers had, this was the method that they used to sort of try to winnow these folks out.
And you say one of the informants was really a teenager.
Yeah, several of them, I think, in fact, were young. One that I observed go through a crowd of about 400 detainees was a teenager, and you know said that he had full knowledge of these people's activities and you know was making choices based on information, not based on anything else. But there were certainly soldiers that expressed skepticism about how much one person could know about about such a large number of people.
Right, and how were the detainees treated? Can you describe that?
In general, they were probably treated better by the U.S. soldiers than they were by the Iraqis. There was one incident I observed where an Iraqi colonel, I think, was interviewing a detainee and didn't like the answer and sort of slapped him across the face, and a U.S. soldier had to tell him to stop doing that sort of thing. But, you know, in general, it's not a pleasant process. It was a very hot sun. They were sitting out for at least a couple of hours. The soldiers did give them water, but their hands were, generally speaking, bound behind their backs with plastic ties or with electrical tape. Some of them were bound so tightly the circulation was cut off to their hands, and so the soldiers would have to cut the cuffs off and redo them. But no, certainly not a pleasant process, and the vast majority of these people that were rounded up were later released.
And some of them were actually taunted, and Abu Ghraib was mentioned.
That's right. Some of the soldiers would say, when there was someone that was sort of positively identified by one of these informants, some of the soldiers would occasionally say, you're going to Abu Ghraib, you're going to Guantanamo, that sort of thing. Not uncommon.
And that was American soldiers?
That was American soldiers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as you're about to leave Talafer, you write about children who congregate in a kind of disturbing situation there as well.
Yeah, that's right. There were lots of children standing around looking at their fathers, essentially, or people that they said were members of their family. And some of the soldiers at one point were trying to throw humanitarian rations to some of these children, food packages, essentially. And in a few cases, some of the children grabbed the rations and threw them back at the soldiers. In one situation, we saw a Kurdish Iraqi army soldier get out of his vehicle and point a pistol at one of the kids who had thrown the ration back at the soldiers and then just get back in his vehicle and drive away. But it was a pretty antagonistic situation.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
Not exactly like this. I guess I'd been out with the military plenty before, but usually what you're observing is sort of combat operations. This was something different, essentially, much more interaction with the local population and sort of very much underscored this problem that they're having across the country, which is the ability to discern, who's fighting them from people that are just trying to live their lives.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
As we said, activists on both sides of the Iraq War will converge in Washington tomorrow. The poet Sharon Olds is adding her voice to those denouncing the war. She's rejected First Lady Laura Bush's invitation to the National Book Festival, which is being held in Washington this weekend. And Sharon Olds, thanks for speaking with us. Tell us, why did you say no?
Because of my feelings of being appalled and shocked and in grief for our country for having done this invasion and continuing this war. And I felt that if, as a poet, I went and participated in the reading and sat down at the table and ate the meals with the First Lady, that I would be, in some sense, acting as if I agreed with our administration rather than was in grievous disagreement with it and opposition to it.
Couldn't there have been a way to sort of attend a festival of some 85,000 people about writing and to have the First Lady's ear to sort of express your opposition and still attend, or couldn't you reconcile that?
I certainly thought about that, and I'm sure there are many writers and artists who are on their way there tomorrow who are going to do just that. But it seemed to me that for me to be there at all seemed to me to be an implicit accepting of her gathering writers who are in disagreement with her and him and them into this sense of celebration, and that everything's kind of okay and the arts are here. And everything isn't okay, and so I thought it was best for me if the arts weren't there, a way of kind of voting with my feet.
Poet Sharon Olds is winner of a National Book Critics Circle Award and professor of writing at New York University. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The largest government rebuilding effort in U.S. history is underway in the Gulf Coast following the devastation from Hurricane Katrina. And there are already questions about the process for deciding who gets some very lucrative reconstruction contracts. This week, the Wall Street Journal reported on the checkered past of some of the businesses hired after Katrina. One example is the Texas ambulance provider Gold Star EMS. The company's under investigation for alleged Medicaid fraud, yet it won a very lucrative subcontract in the recovery effort. FEMA insists there is a procedure in place to review Katrina contractors and says the government has set up a new office for Katrina oversight after politically connected companies like Halliburton, which was once run by Vice President Dick Cheney, quickly won contracts. Joining us on the line is Danielle Bryan. She's executive director of the nonpartisan watchdog group, the Project on Government Oversight. Danielle, what concerns you about these contracts?
Well, we have a number of things that worry us greatly. One is what people are very conscious of, the no-bid contracts. The companies that, you know, immediately the government turns to give them really, you know, multi-million dollar contracts, when we have on our website a database that shows how often they are guilty of misconduct in their previous dealings with the government. Why is it that we keep going back to those same players? The second thing is, because we aren't competing so many of these contracts, are we getting the best people to do the work at the best price? And you know, the whole economy was built on the concept in America of the free market, and our government does not operate that way at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the kinds of contracts that we conduct with these contractors are not transparent. We've been trying to create a database, and even government people are using our little tiny nonprofit website to figure out which agencies are giving contracts to whom. But it's not transparent. And even when we do get, for example, the Army Corps of Engineers, it does the best job the government is doing in the various agencies and saying, well, this is who we're giving a contract to. All they'll say is, we are contracting with, and I won't say just Halliburton, but that's, of course, the one that upsets everyone because
right,
it's the first
right.
one to go to. But it says, you know, up to $16 million, and then there are 10 task orders within that contract. But the public and even the Congress can't see the task order is what we want to know. We want to know, well, exactly they're getting paid what to do what.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the stuff that we can't get.
Some of the stories we're hearing also, though, involve subcontractors, and the rules are different for subcontractors, yes?
That's right. And the government has become pretty hands-off letting these prime contractors make a lot of the rules. We're also very worried about how subcontractor time is actually charged back to the government. The big companies have been successful in actually being able to vastly ratchet up the price they charge the government for subcontract work, which was nowhere near as expensive to the prime.
I'm sure the argument on the other side would be, though, in a national emergency of this scale, shouldn't we be able to take emergency measures to make sure that this work can get done quickly?
I think, well, first of all, that's true. We have to make sure, and we did make sure, that money and contracting rules were not stopping the urgent needs. The reality is that our contracting system also always had flexibility in place so that when there was an urgent need, you didn't have to go through a 35-day or 45-day bidding period. Those things were already waived. What we're worried about now is the really multi-million into the many billion-dollar contracts are not the urgent need contracts. They're the long-term engineering and rebuilding contracts. And that's the work that, frankly, the federal government may not know who the best people are for that job. They may not be the traditional federal contractors. There are many engineering and contracting companies across the country who are probably highly qualified to do that work, but they're not getting a chance to even bid for it.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain what changes there have been to some of the rules since Katrina?
Yes. Yeah, so the one that drew the most attention was that hundreds of thousands of federal employees have had access previously to a purchase card, which the theory made sense. Rather than having to go through the purchasing office in a department to buy pens and pencils for the office, you had your own card that you could just go to the website of Home Depot, or I mean Office Depot, and you know, buy purchases for the government. And the credit limit for those cards was $2,500. Even with those credit limits, we saw extraordinary amounts of misconduct with the use of them, where people were buying personal property or personal items for themselves. They were actually using them in gambling casinos. The famous case was a Navy official who bought his girlfriend, who was a Hooters waitress, breast implants with his government purchase card. Mm-hmm. So here these cards existed. Hundreds of thousands of government employees have them. In the wake of Katrina, they decided to increase the credit threshold to $250,000. And there are over 300,000 people who have these cards. And there's so little accountability on how that money is spent. And there's also, I mean, even assuming everyone's being honest, when you have that many people who can spend that much money, and there's no time limit on it, you know, a year from now, people will still have those cards. There's no centrality in deciding who's buying what. I mean, it's really almost chaotic.
It seems that when you listen to this and this sort of rush to get these emergency things in place so things can be taken care of, I think it begs the question, why didn't we think of this beforehand? Couldn't we have contracts in place before the emergency strikes?
Absolutely. This is just a case of a total failure of leadership in thinking. We at FEMA, for example, are an agency that is planning for disasters. There are basic things that they should already have had in line for whatever eventuality would take place in whatever part of the country, who their contractors were for debris cleanup, who their contractors are for providing water, providing emergency shelter, and have those already lined up so that as soon as you need it, you mobilize it to whatever region who needs it. It just, none of that was in place.
Hmm. What about, you mentioned Halliburton, what about other politically connected companies that have won contracts? What about the review process there? Is there one?
There is not a review process in terms of who gets the contracts. We have now, I think, a really troubling system where we actually, the federal agencies have what are called schedules of companies that are centrally have been already approved as government contractors. It's not for any particular product or service. And it clearly doesn't take into account misconduct in that company's previous dealings with the government. So what you have is not necessarily a case where, you know, Cheney calls up and says, I want you to hire my company. But you do have, because, of course, a lot of agencies in the Pentagon are already dealing with Halliburton because of Iraq. It's easy for the Army Corps of Engineers to turn around and say, well, we already are dealing with you. Let's just go and have you do this work here. And that's just not the way you're going to get the best person providing the best service at the best price.
If you could make one recommendation for this to improve, Danielle, what would it be?
Transparency. Open up the process. Let the public see who is getting the contracts, who is getting the subcontracts, and how much they're charging for them.
Danielle Bryan is executive director of the nonpartisan watchdog group, the Project on Government Oversight. Still to come, a doctor and satirist team up to answer some of life's difficult questions. You're listening to Here and Now. Major League Baseball is heading into the next to last weekend of the regular season with several playoff spots still up for grabs, especially in the American League. In fact, it's possible that last year's World Series champions, the formerly long-suffering Boston Red Sox, might not even punch a postseason ticket. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield, joins us in studio to sort it all out. And Bill, can't be for the Red Sox fans. They might be left out this year?
They might be left out. I mean, one thing we can say for sure is either the Red Sox or the Yankees will make it to the postseason, but no assurances that both will.
Many people thought that that it would be the Red Sox and the Yankees, but what about the rest of the American League?
I love the Indians.
Really?
Yes, they were so far behind the White Sox earlier this summer, 15 games behind, and they were still talking up a good game. You know, maybe we'll make the wild card. They've charged like crazy the second half of the summer, and they have a real possibility of winning that division and certainly of getting the wild card if they don't win the division.
And what about the National League, though?
Well, talk about the National League starts with the National League West and the search for a decent team, and you don't find any. They may cough up the only team to make the postseason without getting 500, without winning as many games as they've lost. San Diego, 76-76, and they're on top of a very bad lot. So that's the first story. The second story is the absolute opposite of that. St. Louis will have the best record in Major League Baseball when the regular season is over, and they clinched their division some time back. So you have the extremes there.
Right. How about players? Anybody catch your eye this season?
Well, the sad thing is that a lot of people are going to remember this season for Barry Bonds and Rafael Palmeiro,
right.
The former being accused of steroid use, the latter being found guilty, at least by laboratory test of steroid use. And that's kind of a shame because you miss a lot of great stories if you only look at the sad ones. And one of the great ones that people may not pay enough attention to is Greg Maddux, pitching for the Cubs now. He won his 318th game last night, and there are only 14 pitchers in the history of the major leagues who've won more than that over the course of a career.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about predictions. What's going to happen?
I will talk about what I would like to see happen,
okay.
Because I would talk. I'm so bad at making predictions. I'm terrible, and usually within 24 hours, anything I say explodes in my face. So it's no use.
Okay, you're qualified.
I'd kind of like to see Houston make the World Series, just because it would be such fun to see Roger Clemens on the mound in a World Series again. And they're a possibility. I'd like to see the Phillies make the World Series, just because that brings such a heap of baggage. Phillies letting fans down almost as many times as the Red Sox have done it before last year.
Well, I don't know about that.
In the American League, sure, it'd be fun to see the hometown team get another shot at it. Maybe win two World Series in a row, kind of pull the Patriots on us. But I love Cleveland, too, just because they've played so well down the stretch.
Is it possible for the Red Sox to really pull another miracle?
Oh, sure, because they're nothing out there but flawed teams. You look carefully at all these teams, and there really is no powerhouse. There really is no team that you look at and say, my goodness, they got strong starting pitching 1-4. Their bullpen's in great shape. Everybody's hitting. They're feeling well. No, there's no team that does it all brilliantly night after night. And so even with their kind of patched up bullpen and very spotty starting pitching and lots of players who decide that they want to take a day off for reasons that nobody can understand at the time, despite all those things, anything can happen over a short span of games.
So this close to the end of the regular season, do you think it's unusual for it to be in this much limbo?
It's delightfully unusual. This is fun, you know? I mean, if you go to bed too early, then the first thing you do in the morning is look at the paper or look at your computer and see how things have changed while you slept. It's more fun than anything else in sports.
All right. Bill, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Littlefield is host of Only a Game. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. And now, for something completely different, we wanted to offer a brief respite from hurricane coverage with a healthy dose of humor. So today we're going to delve into some of the mysteries of life, like what causes an ice cream headache? Why are yawns contagious? And do werewolves really exist? New York City ER Dr. Billy Goldberg has been asked these questions for years, so he teamed up with satirist Mark Lehner to explore these mysteries in their best-selling book titled Why Do Men Have Nipples? Robin Young asked Mark and Billy that urgent question and more. We should warn you, some of their explanations for these mysteries may be a bit too candid for young listeners. Here's Robin.
We have to get right to the title. Billy, why do men have nipples?
I've put a moratorium on saying the word nipples anymore. I find myself doing it all the time. Basically, what happens is the first 6 weeks of life, men and women develop the same way. In utero, they develop along a female template. And then at 6 weeks, the male chromosome kicks in and men develop their man stuff. And they're left behind with a pair of nipples as a memory.
I like the way that the doctor refers to it as the man stuff.
Yes.
His jargon is just impenetrable.
I'm trying to keep it simple, please. Doctors often use unintelligible language to make themselves seem more intelligent. I'm a man of the people.
Well, in fact, when you bumped into Mark in the emergency room, I guess you two were teaming up originally on some short-lived television program. He was the one who had all sorts of medical knowledge. He regaled you with the precise pharmacokinetics of Jimson weed, a Fijian folk remedy for cannibal ingestion, the history of turf toe and crotch rot. Mark, what Yes. was your interest in medicine?
I have been fascinated with the body in all its splendor and all its glorious excretions since I was a young lad. So when I met Billy, we were both actually working on a TV show. We were working on a medical drama, and Billy was the medical consultant. I revel in our friendship, and I revel in the access Billy gives me to
glorious excretions.
To glorious excretions and all his instruments.
Right, and so people who ever wondered what is that stuff that comes out of your nose and other places, that's addressed in the book. But before we get to more of that, Dr. Bill, I just want you to recount the moment where you two meet each other and research this TV show. You were in the emergency room, and a patient came in who, bless him, had some mental issues. And what happened in that moment?
It was mental issues compromised probably by some drug ingestions, either amphetamines or cocaine. And he was a Latino gentleman who was just spouting on about the fact that he's Superman. He was like, I am Superman. Jimmy, Lois, Clark. And just going on. And Mark was at my side. And what we try and do is we try and give this person some sedation, put in an IV carefully, give him some sedation. But Mark was there, so it became a different experience for me because Mark was able to identify with this man in all his
delusions
and agitation and come up with the perfect solution to his agitation, which was?
I said in a stage whisper, give him kryptonite. And this worked.
And now you're on call. Anytime there's a delusional comic book hero around, right, we call you.
Well, and since the show was, as we said, short-lived, off you went to write the book and answer all these questions that you, Dr. Billy, have been asked at cocktail parties all these years. So let's just get some answers. For instance, Dr. Bill, why are yawns contagious?
You know, that's a question that everyone loves, and unfortunately there's not a great answer to why they're contagious. They used to think it had to do with the levels of oxygen in the air, and if there was a low level of oxygen, people would yawn. Therefore, a lot of people in the room would yawn. But that turns out not to be true. And what they think it is they think it's a kind of a social behavior. So it's really a manner of people imitating others.
Hmm. We've also discovered that, you know, the single goldfish in bowls yawn, which we found sort of fascinating. But I think that's just because they're very bored.
Yeah, there are a lot of species that yawn, fish, birds.
Well, question for you, Mark. Can you get high by licking a toad?
You've chosen his question very carefully, I see.
I've been high first, though, and then I've licked the toad. I think that's the problem. I think the answer to that is yes, there are toads.
Yeah, there's a toad called the bufo toad.
In South America.
No, actually, in the United States. In
Trenton, New Jersey?
In the Southwest, there's a lot of bufo toads. And they secrete a substance that is really similar to LSD and serotonin, and it can cause hallucinations.
What about the Erectoris pilorum? That's what
goose flesh.
Yeah. What is it?
Hey, thank you.
Dr. Lehner.
I'll take medicine for 60.
What is a goose bump?
There are little erectile muscles at the base of each hair follicle, and when they become erect, That's what we call goosebumps or goose flesh or
chicken flesh. There's a lot of names
flesh.
For it. But it's really it's a central nervous system response. It's your fight or flight response that allows those kind of little erector muscles to lift
right.
the hair.
Or cold. Or up. Cold can do it.
Yeah, that's the closest we're going to come, by the way, to the chapter on sex.
using that word.
Well, yes. But the chapter on sex is fascinating. And I guess, Dr. Bill, that brings us to what is the most popular question? What is the one that everybody wants to know?
The ice cream headache is a very popular one.
Oh, by the way, yeah, why do you get an ice cream headache?
I love Slurpees. What happens is that cold liquid or ice cream cools the palate and it cools the air in the frontal sinuses. And there's a lot of nerve endings there. So when the air gets cooled, it changes the blood flow to those nerve endings and they start to rapidly fire. And that causes the severe headache.
Well, before we let you go, which are your favorites that are in the book? Mark, start with you.
I think my favorite is the question about whether there is actually such a thing as a werewolf. There are two conditions, two syndromes, that cause people to very much mimic what we are familiar with as a kind of movie werewolf. There's something called porphyria, and there's something called hypertrichosis universalis, which causes people to have hair growth over the entirety of their bodies. And it has so fascinated me that I have discovered a family of werewolf-like men in Mexico. They're called the Wolf Boys of Mexico. They have their own website. One of them just got married, so he has his wedding photos up on the website.
Dr. Bill, yours?
See, that was the problem, because we're on the radio and I have to behave myself. But I reside most often in the pee and poo chapter or in the sex chapter, so... I can keep it clean. There's a question about masturbation and about whether it causes stuttering or hairy palms.
Or blindness.
Or blindness. And there's a fascinating paper, actually, in the Journal of the American Medical Association that talks about masturbation and ejaculation frequency. And there's a group of people who are more frequent masturbators, and it shows that they have actually decreased incidence in prostate cancer.
I'm thinking of all the 13-year-old boys who are hearing that and saying, that's so great. What's prostate cancer?
They're going to put signs on their door says, Mom, please go away. I'm curing prostate cancer.
Let's see. Okay, I have one last one for you because who knows, it might happen and I need to know. If I get bitten by a snake, should I suck out the venom?
No.
You really should just wash it out with soap and water.
If you can grab the snake and give it a Slurpee, it will be disabled from being able to administer its venomous coup de grace.
Because it'll get one of those ice cream headaches.
Bad headache.
That's exactly
right. Have you ever seen a rattlesnake with an ice cream headache? It's quite a sight.
Well, if you get bitten, you could do worse than go see emergency room Dr. Billy Goldberg. And if that fails, Mark Lehner will make you laugh. They both have teamed up on the new book, Why Do Men Have Nipples? Thank you. What a respite from the storm.
Yeah. That's what we're hearing.
Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
It was fun.
Pleasure.
And go to our website where we've set up an online quiz of some of these obscure medical facts. You can test your knowledge at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.